The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, just imagine if you went to bed one night with your bank deposits intact and the next day you found out because for political reasons and actually patriotism, you just lost about 10% of your deposits, but you should be happy for it. And pretend also that it wasn't a decision by the U.S. government that caused that, but by some entity outside of the government that told you, oops, you just lost your deposit.
And you should be happy about participating. Now, there's a number of things that we need to talk about. One is the idea of a wealth tax.
Yeah.
The other is the nature of trust and, what you're dealing with in terms of market expectations and how critical that is.
Right.
Another is the context of these decisions is critical. And I think understanding the context for any decision is absolutely key. And we'll look at that too. But, what we're revolving around in our conversation today is what happened in Cyprus over the weekend. And you think, what does Cyprus have to do with anything? It's a small island in the middle of the Mediterranean. Does it really have an importance to us here in the United States or to someone in Shanghai or to someone in Spain or Italy, perhaps?
Well, and I didn't take a poll on this, but I just wonder how many people, when they heard there was a problem in Cyprus, had to go to Google Maps to find out where the heck it was. I mean, it's that small, and that's the way the news is really trying to portray it. They're really down-talking this breach of trust in the deposit system.
Now, from the Great Depression of the 1930s forward, politicians have realized the need to reinforce the idea of bank deposits being safe.
Right.
Trust broke down in the bank runs of the 1930s when people realized that investment decisions by bankers were not as sound as they originally believed they were. And then when they wanted their money back, they found that liquidity was fairly scant. They didn't have all the money there. It had been invested in farmland. It had been invested in mortgages, stuff that didn't give them immediate access to their funds.
And enter the FDIC. Okay, the FDIC came to reinstill that trust that was lost.
Yeah, arguably, the FDIC was nothing more than window dressing for the banking industry, creating that sense of security. And that's very important because it gives investors a sense of calm in relation to their assets.
Right.
Depositors need to feel secure with their deposits in the hands of others. And this is the issue. With a breaking of social trust in the 30s, they had to have that added assurance that was needed in order to rebuild confidence. So, with time, security becomes an underlying assumption. And that's what we've had from the 30s forward. Security becomes an underlying assumption amongst depositors. It's something that is never questioned.
Right. And what's amazing to me, David, I've talked to people who lived during the Depression for years. I've talked to them. And they have regained that sense of security to the point where they trust banks almost too much. It's a strange dichotomy because they lost their assets the last time. There's story after story of people who lost assets. But the FDIC and the way the banks have operated up to this point, at least in our lifetimes, has not given us the reason to believe that we would just all of a sudden lose our money.
Well, and what's interesting is Cyprus is one thing we will spend some time talking about, but these banks have proprietary trade desks that are essentially gambling with depositor money. And granted, they're doing it on a scale, and it's not supposed to impair the assets of the bank. Everything's supposed to be very safe. The issue of JP Morgan and things getting a little out of control with the London Whale, okay, it was one event. Look at all the other years in which these speculative activities have taken place and did not impair. In fact, helped the bank grow stronger. There is this sense of,
we're Goldman Sachs doing God's work. They're doing God's work. As they're losing money for their investors, they're doing God's work.
And depositors don't ask any questions until it appears that something's going wrong. And then they say, you were doing what with my money?
Right.
Wait, this is different. This is different because you're talking about, again, externalities. But as you say, even with our clients who lived through the 1930s, history fades. Experience with that threat of loss dissipates. Even in 2008, we had the extraordinary measures of insured maximum deposits. They went from 100,000 to 250,000.
Which is still in place.
Right. Yeah. And then they also said, we'll give you unlimited coverage as long as it's a non-interest-bearing account. So you could have $5 million sitting in a bank, and it was all insured. As long as you signed off on not receiving any interest income, then it was all covered. Well, they rescinded that in December. Many people don't know that. But that blanket guarantee went away just recently for the FDIC. They still have the $250 in place. But again, in the context of 2008, that reassured depositors that their assets were safe in, frankly, the worst financial storm in decades. So, you know, looking at the 30s, the issue was one of bank solvency, and the concern was market-related. It was market-determined, the loss was. Excess lending, increased concentration of loans and illiquid assets, specifically farmland. The issue in Europe is very different. It's the idea of a governmental body stepping in to conscript capital on a non-voluntary basis.
Which is that's theft, Dave.
Well, using the assets in question, yes, they're buttressing a sovereign fiscal issue, but they're describing it as a bail-in, not a bailout, a bail-in. You're being asked to participate, invited, in essence, to participate. You get to bail in the bank that you are a depositor with.
Well, let me ask you, though, private property. What is private property if a government can step in or a bank can step in and just take your money away?
Again, this is a context where everybody has to do their duty. What rubs me the wrong way, number of things rub me the wrong way here. One is what you just mentioned, private property. Whose asset is it? When someone takes something from someone else without permission, that is generally thought of as theft. Fairly straightforward. Unless, of course, the idea originates from the government, in which case it's called a tax, it's called a levy, in this case it's called a bail-in. But remember that sleight of hand is nothing more than a diversion from the truth. What we have here is theft.
Well, David, in the past, we've recommended a book that actually is on our website. You can read it for free. It's Bastiat's The Law. But what Frederick Bastiat said back in 1850 was when a government does that, that's legal plunder. They're legalizing the plunder of their people. It's still another form of theft.
Well, this is the new reality in the European banking system. Again, this may be a Cypriot issue, but it was proposed by the Eurozone leadership, and they've shown their cards. Essentially, what they've revealed is their disposition towards private property. Mm-hmm. Your assets are yours unless needed for a greater purpose. Again, philosophically, this drives me crazy because it basically says the individual has no value, only the collective has value.
Sure.
You, as a part of the greater, certainly contribute something, but on your own are expendable. The second thing that just drives me crazy, I mean, first is the private property is essentially being called into question. Number two, it rubs me the wrong way because the levy was set by a transnational group. Actually, a variety of them. The Eurozone leadership is not the Cypriot government.
Right.
And the IMF. And it was laid out as a precondition for a $10 billion euro bailout.
So the Cyprus citizen never voted. There's no representation. They never voted for anyone in the IMF. They never voted for anyone in the Eurozone. Yet they're the ones who are actually trying to mandate this loss.
This is the quid pro quo for external money coming in. And it's not a domestic solution. It wasn't proposed democratically. But you do have the Cypriot Parliament, which, you know, we'll see how this turns out in terms of approving the measure, denying it, changing the details.
Well, David, there are issues here, whether it passes or not. I mean, they're already in a bank holiday.
No, of course. Even if it doesn't pass a parliamentary vote, you've had 6 days which have passed since the bank holiday began, with depositors seeing the power of the European governing body implementing policy, or at least moving towards it, without prior democratic approval. And it feels, frankly, a lot like what we've had here in the United States, signing statements, executive orders. Essentially, it races past a normal legislative process where voters are represented, and it allows, frankly, and this is what's most disturbing, it allows for authoritarian dictates to roll over the rights of individuals. And this raises the third issue, the third thing that really rubs me the wrong way, which is the rule of law. Whose rule of law is in practice here? Is this a sovereign Cyprus? Is this a subjugated Cyprus to the Eurozone dictates? The rule of law is an underpinning to a healthy functioning society, to a healthy functioning economy. The rule of law is being replaced with the rule of caprice.
Well, and you know what's interesting about this rule of law, though, Dave? We've seen dictatorships and tyrannies come in, fascism. We've seen this in the 20th century. We've even seen it in the 21st century. But the thing is, the market in this particular case is the one that casts the vote. You can come up with as much confiscation as you want in a given country. You can throw away the rule of law, but what have you done to the minds of the people of what they thought was a plain vanilla deposit, and now it's something to be worried about?
That is absolutely vital. And, you know, just to reiterate, you mentioned The Law by Frederick Bastiat. That book is must reading. That is essential reading. Right. I don't care if you're in the sixth grade. I don't care if you're 65 years old or 106 years old. That is must reading. If you haven't read that, you've missed something in terms of political dialogue. How do politics really function? Through time, what do we see in terms of the morphing, either with an appreciation for the rule of law, or the sort of negative deterioration, a devolution in the political process where the law is either abused or ignored completely.
Right. Well, and it's a short book. You can read it in less than an hour. Okay. And it's not Democrat or Republican. There's no partisanship. This is written by a Frenchman in the 1850s observing society.
Well, the market expects, as you said earlier, the market expects bank deposits to be plain vanilla. It expects them to be boring. It expects them to be safe, and it expects them to be available right when needed. So if expectations change, this is the unfortunate thing, so does investor behavior. You can either see at this point capital flight, which would be sort of bank runs, the most extreme version of capital flight, or just a realignment or rearrangement of investor expectations, greater yield on the deposits to compensate for greater risk.
Sure. That's interest rates rising. We've been talking about that for a long time. Even though the risk has been rising, they've been keeping interest rates low.
Yeah. If there's no expectation of loss, then you can get away with paying absolutely nothing on the deposit. But now if there's 10% in play, if there's 3% in play, 5% potential loss, there has to be adequate compensation. Otherwise, guess what happens? Risk and reward don't remain in balance. And depositors, this is what they woke to. Depositors awoke on Saturday to the reality of risk to their assets, a risk they had never considered before. And for some, this is going to drive money into the mattress. Mm-hmm. For others, it's going to drive the expectation, as we mentioned, of higher rates to justify assets remaining on deposit.
Well, what do you say to the person, though, who says, look, Cyprus, this is just a banking country. It was built to bank, and you've got Russian mafia money in there. What do you say to the person on financial TV who says, hey, Cyprus is a unique, it's a one-off type of thing?
Well, okay, Cyprus, it is a unique one. No other country in Europe has as distorted a banking sector relative to the total size of its economy.
Right.
That in itself makes Cyprus unique. Pundits will argue that you won't see this repeated in the Eurozone or in other peripheral European countries because you're dealing with different facts, different variables, different needs. All of that is true. But for the average depositor, you've just negatively impacted the belief that deposits are always and everywhere sacred and untouchable. That's what you've done. The damage done is not that we expect to see the Eurozone start to roll over on bank depositors all throughout Europe.
That's not going to happen. The doubt is cast at this point.
The doubt is cast. It doesn't matter that it would not happen elsewhere, given different banking variables and different fiscal concerns. The depositor now has in mind a possibility that hitherto was not possible. And when the impossible becomes possible, that's where recalibration occurs.
It's in their minds.
It's like trying to remove the idea of a dancing pink elephant from your mind. It may not have been in your mind a moment ago, but try as you may, once it's there, it's like a virus. Try not to think about it. That pink dancing elephant is there. And this is made worse by the sensitivities created over the last 5 years of crisis in the global economy and acute European crisis over the last 2 to 3 years. Context is key.
Yeah, David, you're absolutely right. Context is key. You know, you still have people arguing about whether we're going into a recovery or whether this is a continuation of the banking crisis of 2008, 2009, 2007. But now you have, for the first time ever, actually, in our lifetimes, we're hearing that the banking system can just go ahead and take money away when they need to.
Well, and it's that issue, context being critical. You already exist in a frail context, which exaggerates the consequences of all decisions. You can look at this in a very dispassionate way and say, this is just not a big deal. This will blow over. In fact, if they don't implement anything, it will go away tomorrow. Once we're beyond the knee-jerk reaction, the markets are in recovery and we can go back to normal. Everything's going to be fine. But again, the context exaggerates the consequences of all decisions. Let me illustrate this in two ways. If you assume a jumbo jet malfunctions every day and crashes, killing everyone on board, one instance is unnerving. Okay. I mean, that happens and everyone says, wow, I mean, I thought we were beyond that. Technology's improved. But what if this was a regular occurrence? One a day, every day, 365 days a year.
Well, I don't think anybody would fly, Dave.
You end up with 100,000 dead people. When all the bags are stacked, you've got 100,000 dead people because of these flights falling out of the sky. Now, how do you feel about flying in that context?
Yeah, I can't see it. I can't see anyone flying.
You're generally more twitchy, whether you're traveling to see family, going off cross country on business. Now, let's switch subjects, but remember that the 747s are dropping out of the sky. How do you feel about getting sick and going to the hospital?
Well, isn't that where you go when you get sick?
According to the World Economic Forum, they have about an 80-page report called their 2013 Risk Assessment. Untreatable bacterial infections are a real and growing threat. 100,000 people die each year in the U.S. from antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections that they contract in the hospital.
So you go in sick, you come out dead.
Well, it changes the emotional context of your hospital stay, doesn't it? I mean, and again, this is the equivalent of a jumbo jet dropping out of the sky, one per day, 365 days a year. You can read the report, World Economic Forum 2013 Risk Assessment. Now remember, this isn't a public health seminar. We're not talking about the number of people that are dying from antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections, but the Eurozone is already on edge, and the simple idea of a levy on deposits is not really a simple levy on deposits. It is pressure on a group of people already preconditioned to be concerned.
Right.
So again, I mean, you look at that hospital stay and you go, wow, knowing that, I don't think I want to go to the hospital. I don't think I want to get sick. I think I want to focus on super immunity. I'm not taking enough vitamin C. In other words, I'm a little agitated thinking about whether or not I have to go to the hospital or not. In fact, we may have a home birth if we have a fourth child. You just think about it and you go, wow, I'm concerned. And I wasn't before. Now knowing those facts, now experiencing the last 2 to 3 years of what we have experienced in the Eurozone, this is not a benign event.
Right.
This is not a benign event.
Well, and David, you know what I think about when a person goes into the bank, it is a relationship. Okay. You go back to the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, and you think of Jimmy Stewart, and he's explaining the relationship he has with each person. You know, that money's in Martha's house, and that money's, but these people know their banker. Now, here's what's interesting. We've all had relationships where doubt enters at some point. And it's so hard to regain that relationship if you've done something
Right. Well, all of us know couples that have had affairs, been through affairs, and, you know, they're trying to mend their bonds of trust.
Right.
Right? Okay.
Sure.
So friends of the family, okay. But now, with that context being there, wandering eyes, a lingering conversation with a person of the opposite sex, issues that are not another affair, but they are exaggerated by the past frailties that linger and create, and again, that's an exaggerated sensitivity given the context.
Based on doubt
that's
from the past.
That's what we have in Europe today. So you can be dismissive on this, but what you're really looking for is whether or not this was the Creditanstalt moment. This era's Creditanstalt moment. Something that you could even say it's insignificant. It's irrelevant.
Right.
But you're already in a frail context.
Well, and, you know, talk about insignificant. It was very significant in 1931, but the problem is people didn't have the internet back then to look up this bank in Austria. Okay. What difference does an Austrian bank make to the rest of the world's banks in 1931? Yet we know that the Creditanstalt moment was the moment that the shoe dropped and the banking failure, which lasted all the way through 1933, it covered the whole world.
It went global following Creditanstalt. So this is the issue. There may be no actual threat to the Italian, the Spanish, or the Portuguese depositors, but already going through austerity, nerves are a little sensitive. Psychological reality may be more important. And again, it's the psychological reality which may be more important than the actual reality. Depositor behavior may trend towards the mattress and away from your brick-and-mortar institutions.
Well, David, for obvious reasons, nobody's wanting to incite a panic. And so you have, when you watch financial TV, Wall Street's, they've got different ideas about this. Wall Street's saying, well, it's not really an issue. And then you've got other people saying, wait a second, like you, this is a big issue.
Well, and you look at Bear Stearns, you look at AIG, and Wall Street and the mass media was very dismissive for 3 months, 6 months, even a year.
Yeah.
You know, you remember Goldman was asking AIG for more collateral.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a year before there was really problems, but you had the canary.
Yeah.
You had the canary in the coal mine, and then things began to unwind from there. JP Morgan had this to say, we would expect future crises to be exacerbated by more extreme deposit flight. This would likely mean the ECB would have to increase its presence as liquidity provider of last resort, which under normal circumstances would lead to increased asset encumbrance and lower recoveries for senior debt. So, I mean, again, the issue here is when there's concerns, this may not be a trigger event for any of those other peripheral European countries. But as and when there is concerns, you're going to see people hit the exits first before they even ask a question. Because again, we're on edge. This tends to, and then I think this is, again, this move away from the brick and mortar and this move towards cash, taking money out of the system. This is where your fiscal problems begin to be exacerbated, begin to be multiplied. It tends to drive fiscal damage deeper because cash transactions the world over go largely unreported. And what I'm saying is basically, if I'm forced, because of the pressure I feel in the banking system, because I feel like I'm going to be at jeopardy with my deposits, and thus forced to take my money out, I'm sitting there in cash. Now, I've done nothing wrong, I'm just sitting on cash, maybe it's $2,000, maybe it's $10,000, maybe it's $200,000 in cash, and now I'm conducting business in cash instead of using credit cards. I am essentially outside of the banking system.
Right.
You see? And it is the people at the receiving end of that cash transaction that have a very practical choice. And I can tell you from experience watching vendors in Europe, there's two different tills. If you're paying with credit card, it goes through one till. And if you're paying with cash, everything gets added up on a calculator. Why? Because they're not paying taxes on anything that comes in as cash. If they screw this up, Kevin, if they screw this up, they're going to drive money into the cash market and ultimately VAT and sales tax, which is a huge component in terms of their revenue, simply goes away. If you drive depositors away from the banking system, you inadvertently drive them into the cash-based economy where VAT, sales tax, business transactions, again, they go largely unaccounted for. That is a fiscal disaster where revenues all of a sudden come to a grinding halt.
Well, you know, David, we're not the only ones saying this either. You know, the people in Cyprus right now, they're asking the question. This was on the news, okay? Are we the guinea pigs? Are we just the small country out there that's being tested right now? Because we all know that Italy right now is actually the bigger issue. If they wouldn't have done, if this Cyprus thing this week, Italy would absolutely be in our face right now as far as the political turmoil there.
Well, right, exactly. Because, I mean, we still have an unresolved election. Who's going to run the country? Who's going to be in charge of the budget? Who's going to be? I mean, there's a lot that is in limbo.
Right.
And obviously there's a little bit more attention being focused on Cyprus. It's not the details that matter on this issue with Cyprus, nor at this point does it matter if any suggested measures are actually implemented.
Right.
We're just basically saying that the bell has been rung and you can't unring it.
Yeah, the bell has been rung. In other words, you've basically said, look, I might steal from you someday.
Right, so depositors have in their minds, for the first time in generations, that their deposits are at risk. Argentina created this fear in 2001. And then they collapsed their banking system, their currency, and the economy. So for the suggestion to come from the Eurozone ministers, the ECB, and the IMF, what you have now is depositors facing a new set of facts. It's not just Argentinian bureaucrats and politicians that see private property as a useful resource for public needs. But from the heart of the Eurozone comes the same acknowledgement.
Right, right.
Individuals are expendable, serve a greater good. That's right. Beyond property rights, there is the statement made that the collective is more important than the individual. Philosophically, we reject that utterly. The whole, in our opinion, derives its value as a sum of the parts. Each part is just as valuable. And that's really not what is being said. That's not so in sort of the collectivist Europe of today.
Well, let's face it. That's Karl Marx versus our system. That's that thinking, okay? Karl Marx believed in Lenin and Stalin and the communists that the whole is more important than the parts. And we don't believe that.
No. At its core, this is an action that illustrates a philosophy, which is why I'm even more opposed to a progressive solution.
Which is also Karl Marx.
Right. Like a progressive tax that bites harder at the top of the food chain, rich and poor alike are endowed by their creator with dignity. And frankly, social class and standing should play no part in policy application. When it does, you have a subtle form of discrimination. And usually that's justified in the hearts and minds of others by some sort of warped sense of social justice or fairness or equality. You may even be able to boil it down simply to envy, but the most likely outcome now in Europe is that an even more progressive levy is implemented, with small accounts being exempted, with large ones paying the difference, a larger amount. And if that's the case, it shouldn't come as a surprise. It shouldn't come as a surprise when the deposits that remain simply choose to find a different jurisdiction. You know, if you're going to take 10-15% out, fine. Don't expect me to be a paying customer from this point forward. I can go somewhere else with my business. And this is the nature where you really have a tenuous situation in Cyprus, because two-thirds of the deposits in the banking system are from foreigners. One-third of those are from Russia, and then the rest of the world has decided that they want a little bit of money in Cyprus too. So two-thirds of the banking system says, this isn't our home turf anyways. If you're going to put the screws to us, guess where we're going? Home or elsewhere. And that's really the issue here.
So what you're saying is if they press too hard, they're just going to collapse the whole banking system and therefore also the country.
Right. Why should any depositor just stung with whether it's 6.75%, 9.9%, 12%, or some higher figure have faith that a one-time event is in fact a one-time event? I'm sure we can all think of instances where the exception to the rule ultimately became the rule.
Right.
And this is what has us primarily concerned. You're basically saying wealth taxes is fine. You know, if and when we need to, we will. We can assess the value of your property. We can get a county assessor to say, this is what your house is worth. This is what your land is worth. Now, 2%, please. Or else. And what is the or else? Well, we own now 2% of your property. If you can't pay because you're not liquid, that's fine. We'll take 2% of the property. We're now a landowner right alongside you. What we're opening up is a Pandora's box in terms of how we appreciate wealth, how we appreciate private property,
right,
how we appreciate the individual's rights, and whether or not those are respected. Or can we just cast those aside for the collective?
Well, and think how tempting that is, though, Dave. How often have you heard about tax levels? You know, okay, they're going to tax at a $500,000 level or $1 million level or a $10 million level. Different rates. It's tempting. When even you believe in this individual equality, okay, that's based on constitutional thought, it's still tempting to go, oh, whew. Dodge that bullet. It doesn't affect me, so let them go ahead and vote how they want.
Right. So at a popular level, the more progressive, the better.
Right.
You know, the 1% pay more, not only in nominal terms, but in percentage terms, and somehow that's justified. Well, in principle, how is that justified? Is one individual deserving of preferential treatment over another? I mean, apparently, there's an assumption that someone in the upper class owes more. But on what basis? I mean, right, ability to pay can be applied to someone with a $20,000 deposit when set next to someone with a $2,000 deposit. I mean, we're really talking about a relative comparison of who's wealthy compared to whom, right? And so who really determines where you draw the line and why? Who determines the quantitative thresholds for who can afford to pay more? And this is where not only does it show that it's completely arbitrary, but it's not based on principle. It's based on the practical application of abusing a democracy. We will take advantage of the minority in order to satiate the appetites or the voting penchant of the majority. If we cannot get away with pressing into the 50%, 60%, 20%, whatever it is, of smaller deposits at the bank, fine, we'll leave them alone and we'll hit the top ones. Yeah, but again, this is government trying to get away with as much as they can. Where are the controls on government?
Right.
Where are the dictates? Where is the rule of law which they have to be subject to in order for us to have a normal functioning society and a normal functioning and healthy economy?
Well, I'll tell you, Dave, I think in this particular case, the rule of law actually will be the natural rule of the markets at some point. You said something when we heard about this Cyprus thing. You said, do you realize the insecurity that has just been introduced into the financial markets? And I thought of that, and I thought, you know what? That's really what we're talking about here. The government can try to do as much as they want progressively until they collapse. Okay, we've seen in the history of societies, when they get to a point where they're absolutely leeching off of the people who are actually paying the tax bill, that the system ultimately collapses. Now, unfortunately, it often ends in war, it ends in bloodshed, it ends in things that we've talked about before, going from the financial to the economic to the political to ultimately the geopolitical. But in this particular case, if this fire starts going, it's going to be like a forest fire, and it doesn't matter what the government wants to do, they'll lose control.
Cannon ring the bell. In our opinion, trust is gone, and that was a commodity you could not afford to lose. We just squandered a very valuable resource on the road to recovery. You know, it's interesting when you look back at the last 100 years, and certainly you could look at several thousand years, and you'd find the same record. You tend to see people focus on paper assets when there's a tremendous amount of trust in the system. And when trust dissipates, they grasp for as much control as possible. Not only do they privatize their wealth, as in take control and make it very quiet,
right,
but they try to get it out of the system. And we're seeing that move happen. We have over the last 10 years, and we think that we're moving towards that final phase of people saying, why should I? Why should I trust a counterparty? Why should I trust the system? Why should I trust the treasury market? Why should I trust stocks and bonds? Why should I trust anything other than an asset in my hot little hand? You know, for the super wealthy, that's going to be Gustav von Klimt. That's going to be Picasso. That's going to be, you know, cases of wine that cost tens of thousands of dollars. For the less well-off but still well-off, that's going to be tangible assets, whether that's diamonds or, I mean, you're seeing this move happen right now in China, where your largest diamond wholesalers in the world are re-headquartering. They're moving their headquarters to Shanghai. Why? Because there's a lot of wealth that says the system here is changing. The system here is changing, and what made our money is now going to take our money, and we need to move. We need to get out. We need to get private. We need to get quiet. And that is the nature of real assets, particularly concentrated real assets, gold, silver, diamonds, things that are transportable, things that have enduring value. That is the trend as trust is broken.
Well, and you know, David, we've been talking about this consolidation on gold that's gone on now, what is it, about 17, 18 months, and it's gone relatively sideways. But you said something to the group here just a few minutes ago before we came in here, and you said, do you realize also you will probably never see gold below $1,600 again in your lifetime? In the next few weeks, months, whatever it is, we are probably witnessing the lowest price that we will ever see gold in our lifetime based on the things that are occurring.
It's quite possible that we've just made the psychological shift into that final phase, again, where people want more control of their resources and don't trust the system. And it's very important that investors think in terms of, again, the context being frail and somewhat disconnected events being triggers for bigger and even worse things. The Archduke being assassinated, that didn't seem to have a real tie into World War I, but the context was already set. We have a frail context. Frankly, it doesn't matter what takes us into the next phase, but we will have something if we haven't already.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.